Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. It's July 6, 2020, to be rebroadcast July 8, 2020 on 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician with my co-host Ron Meniza. While the UConn Student Union is closed, we're broadcasting live on Mondays at 10 o'clock a.m. on Facebook Live. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, and Spotify. You can also check out my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at FranStorchND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. All right, so we're going to talk about hygiene first this morning, and we're going to talk about why you should wear a mask. So this weekend, I got a little bit triggered because we went shopping again. We went to a couple of grocery stores, and I saw at least three people in one grocery store wearing a mask, covering their mouth and not their nose. So I want to talk to you about why this is ineffective and also kind of ridiculous. I know that there are people there who are figuring out, well, if I go into the store, I have to wear a mask, but I can't breathe if the mask is covering my mouth and my nose, so I'm going to leave my nose out so I can breathe. So please understand this.
This is a pet peeve.
The virus is contracted. One of the main ways the virus is contracted is by droplets. The coronavirus is contracted by droplets. So if somebody speaks, coughs, or sneezes, and you breathe the droplets in, the virus enters through your nose and or your mouth. So your mouth and your nose are ways that the virus can get in. If your nose is uncovered, virus can get in there. Also, if you sneeze or cough, you can release virus. Please let me remind you, in this time of quarantine, in this time of the coronavirus, we are assuming that everyone, every single person is potentially contaminated. We are making the grand assumption that we are all either asymptomatic carriers or pre-symptomatic. That is why everyone is expected to wear masks, is to protect you and to protect other people. If you wear a mask indoors and you don't cover both your nose and your mouth, you could potentially be infected and you could potentially infect other people. If you say, well, I have a condition and I just can't wear a mask, or I have a condition and it scares me to cover both my mouth and my nose, or my condition is such that I just can't, I really can't breathe well, I have COPD or I have chronic bronchitis or I have some kind of a condition where I can't keep them both. All right, then be a good citizen. This is how you be a good citizen. You do not go into the store. If you cannot cover or you won't cover your nose and your mouth, don't go into situations where you're going to be close to people uncovered. And if the store is requiring you to wear a mask, you shouldn't be in the store at all. And if you're like, but I have to go shopping. Okay, well, get somebody else to shop for you. Someone who is willing or is able to cover their nose and their mouth. That is the kind thing to do. That is the safe thing to do. That is the sensible thing to do. I understand if you, for some reason, you can't cover your nose and your mouth because you have a health condition, because you have PTSD, because you have some other kind of condition, because you just, or you just feel like, I feel suffocated, I feel like I can't breathe. If you can't breathe with that mask on, if that's how you feel, or if you really have a condition where you can't do it, you don't belong in the store. You need to stay out of situations where you're supposed to have a mask on. And if you need someone else to shop for you, that's the right thing to do. Please do that. So this is kind of a public service, and this is my belief. You just never know. I mean, the thing is, I don't like to judge people who are walking around with their noses sticking out, but I find myself doing it, and I know it's not right, but when I see them, I try to stay 6 feet away from them or more and just generally stay away from them. And I can assume that they're being defiant or inconsiderate, but they could also be just ignorant and they really can't help the way that they feel. But what they aren't understanding is they shouldn't be in the store. They shouldn't be close to people. They shouldn't be in situations where really you should be wearing a mask.
We have other safety laws in effect, like seatbelt laws. Most people have complied to that. Most people do that.
And early on in seatbelts, people protested that too.
Oh, big time, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, less people die in car accidents because of it.
That's right.
Oh, there you go.
that's right. So mask wearing has become a fierce topic of debate in the United States. People have staged protests. One person even quit their job because they received a death threat for ordering masks. And so different states are ordering people to wear them in public. Other states are telling municipalities that they can make the decisions. And politicians are arguing about it. But more and more, the research is showing when you cover your face, you prevent the droplets from spreading. There was a meta-analysis of 172 studies that looked at various interventions to prevent the transmission of various coronaviruses. And the analysis that was published in The Lancet on June 1st found that mask wearing significantly reduces the risk of viral transmission. It makes sense. The things cover your face. They make it so that droplets have a harder time getting in and a harder time getting out. And it's a really large effect. So now a lot of the studies analyzed healthcare and not in the community, and they were also observational. So what we really should be doing, we really needed to have is a study of mask wearing in the public. But they are still a key component of what we have to fight the coronavirus. People still remain skeptical because at the beginning of the pandemic, they were telling us you only need to wear a mask if you're infected, and they don't really help people who aren't infected. But really, they were saying that because there was a shortage of personal protective equipment. There's going to, when things come out of your mouth, they get caught by the cloth mask. And even a low quality cloth mask can catch a lot of droplets. So there was a study that was published in Nature Medicine that looked at people infected with the flu and seasonal coronaviruses, found that even loose-fitting surgical masks blocked almost all the contagious droplets the wearers breathed out. So, and the other thing I'm finding is that, I went to Walgreens in Colchester on Saturday, and at the checkout, they're selling inexpensive boxes of just the plain surgical masks. They're getting easier and easier to find. You don't have to just even buy them online. You can go to the drugstore and get them, and they're not expensive. So they're very accessible to you. So you don't just have to have the cloth mask. Because when I wear a cloth mask, I'll wear it for the day and then I toss it in the wash. So I have to have a number of cloth masks because I don't do the laundry every day. So I find that having those extra disposable masks are convenient. And because they're more available, I can keep them in my office too, and they can hand them out to people. And then if people come to my house and we have a physically distanced outdoor gathering, if people need a mask, I can give it to them. You know, I just have extras around. So they're just becoming so easy to have. There was a study that was published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society A that concluded that if a majority of a population wore face masks in public, even just homemade ones, this could dramatically remove transition of the virus and help future waves of the pandemic. And we are still in the first wave. People are worried about the second wave. Be concerned about the first wave.
Yeah, we have not done a good job here in this country at all with the first wave. We started it back up. We started too late, and then we reinstated too early.
Right. And the thing is, if people would follow the hygienic practices, we could open up a lot more safely, and you wouldn't see these horrible, overwhelming statistics down south in Texas and Florida and Arizona and these terrible hotspots that are happening. Surgical masks are designed to protect people from the wearer. Because they fit loosely, the wearer can still breathe in unfiltered air from the sides. Even so, surgical masks provide benefit to the wearer as well. That laboratory testing has found that surgical masks block out 75% of respiratory droplet-sized particles. They say that you should avoid, those masks with the valve? You shouldn't use those.
Really?
Because they let unfiltered air out. So it won't protect other people if you're contagious.
Oh.
Yes.
But those are the ones that also are easier to breathe with.
Yep.
And you don't fog your glasses as easily.
Yes.
Right.
But they let you breathe out. And I didn't realize that. I'm not going to wear mine anymore then.
Right.
Yeah. As for cloth masks, the protection depends on what they're made of and how well they fit. But with the right combination of materials, you can create a cloth mask that offers protection to wear 30 to 50% range or more. So So just a cloth mask. And the thing is, if everybody did all the hygienic things, we would be out of this a lot sooner.
Uh-huh.
Yep, that's exactly how it works. So let's talk about hygiene basics, and let's also talk about hydration basics.
Okay, as you're drinking a glass of water.
That's actually fizzy water, but yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, someone went and did her exercise before she got on the air. And it's hot out.
Yeah, it is hot out.
It's not terribly hot out yet. It's still...
summer out. It's
when
nice.
I walked in, it was below 70, below 80, but not much.
Right. And you were out dancing in the ultraviolet rays.
I was. What can I say?
Good for you, right?
Yeah.
Right.
It was fun. Mm. I did use sun protection. All right. Let's talk about hygiene. Hygiene, I like to think of hygiene as a feminine thing because hygiene is something that is and was promoted by women. Yes, the men studied, they studied the microorganisms and they brought out, you know, all the great studies on hygiene, on microorganisms came from men. But the practice of hygiene came from women. So let's start out. Do you know that the word hygiene, do you know where it comes from?
I have your notes in front of me, so I shouldn't probably answer that, should I?
All right. So
I don't want to ruin it for you.
That's okay. All right. So I'll tell you. Okay. So hygiene comes from Hygieia, who is the Greek goddess of health. And notice that health, which is the thing that I preach and practice and help people with, it comes from a goddess. Comes from a couple of goddesses, Hygieia and also Althea. She's another Greek goddess of healing. So anyway, do you know that in the Middle Ages, life expectancy was in the teens because of the high infant mortality rate and poor sanitation?
Wow.
Because refuse and animal and human waste were dumped into the streets.
That's probably not too smart. Huh?
It was awful. Do you get that?
Awful.
Awful.
Yeah.
Awful. Yeah, awful is a
it's a
word for stuff you dump into the streets. It's spelled O-F-F-A-L.
Oh,
I'm sorry I had to explain that to you.
Oh, that's bad.
Yeah.
That's
so bad. So for those of you who don't know the word awful, you can look it up, O-F-F-A-L, and it is awful that they dumped awful into the streets.
Right.
So if Kate Knight is listening, she would have gotten that joke.
Yeah.
All right. So anyway.
Yes, she would have.
So there were heroic scientists that brought about the germ theory of disease. When the advances of the Industrial Revolution and the discovery of the germ theory of disease brought about public health measures that, building upon the importance of good hygiene and sanitation, culminated in the rise of the scientific era of medicine. And there were heroes and heroines of this age. And they were such notable figures as Edward Jenner, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Ignaz Semmelweis, Florence Nightingale, Rudolf Virchow, Clara Barton, notice there are a couple women there,
yeah.
Louis Pasteur, who invented pasteurization,
right.
Which is, you know, boiling, you boil water or you boil a liquid just below boiling temperature
right.
for a period of time to kill most of the bacteria.
Otherwise known as ruining imported beer.
And milk, yeah.
And milk.
I know. But you know, killing a lot of microorganisms.
You know, yeah.
Joseph Lister, so you know Listerine? That's why Listerine is called Listerine, because of him. Because
really?
Of Joseph Lister. Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah. Henri Dunant and Robert Koch.
Okay.
So those were all the people who, you know, those were all scientists who studied, you know, that brought about the germ theory and also promoted hygiene. So do you know what purpural fever is?
Nope.
It's not a fever where you turn purple. So puer is a Latin/French word for a little child. So puer tea is very young tea. I don't know if it's because it's fermented for a short while or it's young leaves, but anyway, that's what puer is. And being the eternal puer is a something that you'll wind up talking to your counselor about when you're dealing with usually a man who forgot to grow up.
Okay.
Yeah. So puerperal fever is when a woman gets sick with a fever after childbirth. And so purple fever, why does it happen? It's because obstetricians and surgeons, they didn't understand the germ theory. So they'd put their hands on a woman when they're assisting her in childbirth, or if they were doing cesarean sections, because cesarean sections have been done, you know, since ancient times. And they didn't understand about washing up. And so purpural fever was conquered when obstetricians and surgeons started washing their hands. Right?
Okay.
So then there's Florence Nightingale, and she championed the need for nurses and hygiene in the fields of the Crimean War and around patient care. She was a big deal when it came to hygiene. I mean, she was a fierce warrior goddess kind of lady. She wasn't just this nice, sweet nursey poo. She was a bad A. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. And in the 1930s and 40s, there was a dramatic increase in longevity. People started living longer because of the widespread practice of hygiene and also the advent of antibiotics. And then by the 1980s, there were further improvements. They figured out about isolating the sick during epidemics, quarantining of ships at ports of disembarkation when there were illnesses on them, disinfection of fomites. Fomites is a surface that tends to harbor infection. So people figured out that we have to clean those things off. Exposure to fresh air and the beneficial rays of sunlight. And, you know, so we have... We had this thought that the virus would calm down during the, during the summer, because, you know, viruses generally do calm down during the summer, but that didn't happen this year. It's just so easy to pass around. And I just wonder, the issue is, if everybody would stay outside, the virus would pass less quickly. But the problem is, that's not where people are catching this. People are catching this because they're gang housing. They're hanging out all over each other indoors. That's where the thing is being spread. So, and people are still doing that, even though it's a time of year when you want to be outside. People who are mostly hanging around outside, they're not getting in large groups. They're not passing the virus around. All right. So anyway, the impact of these measures was enhanced by education and promotion of personal hygiene and communal sanitation, including the use of potable running water and the proper disposal of wastes. So you didn't have that awful, awful in the streets.
Yes.
Yes. Isn't there a milkshake called an awful, awful?
The Newport Creamery, I think, used to put out the awful, awful. It was out of Rhode Island.
Yeah.
And it was called the awful, awful.
Yeah. And I asked Chris DiPaolo why it was called an awful, awful. And he said to me...
That it makes you awfully full?
No.
Or no?
No.
Why?
It was awful, awful good.
It was awful, awful good. It was also awful, awful filling.
Yeah,
it was really,
I'm sure.
Like,
yeah.
Like,
yeah, I would,
filling.
I would use my calories for 2 days in one of those.
Yes, like, you would.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd do that.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. So with the avoidance of self-destructive behavior, cessation of smoking, maintenance of ideal body weight, proper regime of exercises, adequate control of blood pressure and cholesterol levels, proper management of stress and so on, one can still stretch a person's lifespan considerably in the 21st century. And over 80% of diseases are associated with unhealthy lifestyles and self-destructive behaviors, and thus are subject to healthy alterations in behavior. So when it comes down to the coronavirus, the hygiene piece is a huge thing. There are two things that are really, really simple and important. One of them is hygiene, and the other is taking good care of yourself. And you have a shot at either not getting this, or if you do get it, getting an asymptomatic or a light case of this. Obviously, I can't promise this because we keep getting bombarded with these stories of people who had no background history and got very, very sick. And I still wonder if the people who have no background history, if you looked into their specific genetics, there's something that was different from them. We don't know, but all you can do is assume that you could be somebody who could catch it. And at this time, take extra precautions. The big thing is don't go places where there are a lot of people. And my personal thing is I wouldn't even go someplace where there's a lot of people outside. Personally, I'm completely supportive of the Black Lives Matter protests. I want justice for all people, and I particularly want justice for Black people at this time. And I personally wouldn't go to the protest. I'm 56 years old. I'm running a business. I have a 65-year-old person in my house.
Hey.
Right. And and I'm running a healthcare business, so I want to reduce my exposure and my risk. So even though the protests, they're saying that it doesn't seem that the protests are spreading extra virus, because when people go, they are outdoors and they're masked. But where people are spreading it are big gatherings where they are unmasked. So I'm wondering what's going to happen. We just had the 4th of July weekend, and we had that big, Trump had a big rally at Mount Rushmore where people were largely unmasked. So we're going to see if there's a spike there. And we're going to start seeing if there are spikes in cases that are related to the different rallies that Trump had, where people were unmasked. And so that's probably going to happen in the different cities where it happened, in Arizona and in Oklahoma and also at Mount Rushmore. So we'll watch to see about that. And also, Trump's son, Donald Jr.'s girlfriend, is now infected with the coronavirus. So, and he also, his the various Secret Service providers for both Trump and Mike Pence keep getting infected, and they have to postpone trips because they have to get new staff. And you wonder if why do they have to keep traveling if they keep exposing their staff? Why do they keep doing that? The thing that's going to help is that, like I said, it's two things. It's pay attention to the hygiene. Washing your hands a lot works. It's helpful. My palms of my hands are kind of itchy because they're dry. There's lotion for that. There's water for that. I'll just use lotion. But I wash my hands so many times in a day, particularly on a work day. For any one patient, I wash my hands before I touch the patient, after I touch the patient. After the patient goes, I sanitize my room, and then I wash my hands again. So at least three times. And then if I'm doing actual physical exam, of course, I do some interim hand washing. So if I touch your feet, generally if I touch your feet, if I have to examine something on your feet, after I'm finished touching your feet, I sanitize before I touch something else on you. Because, you know, feet have funk on them. So now you're looking at 4 to 5 times per patient that I wash my hands. And that's with a combination of hand sanitizer. And like after I'm done sanitizing the room, I generally leave the room and go and wash my hands with soap and water. So I'm doing a lot of hand washing. And so the hand washing, and then anytime I'm out in public, if I'm out, you know, if I go to the store, and that's the main place I'm going to inside where there are other people, to the store, and try to do that as infrequently as possible. I go in, get my stuff, and get out, and always wear a mask. So the hand washing and the mask wearing, and like I said, we're not gathering in large groups, and we've been invited to do some large group things. I don't know if we're going to go. We are doing outdoor bike rides in small groups where we're spacing each other and we're distancing from each other while we're doing it. We're not riding in pace lines. We're not riding close together. And we're going in groups of no more than 6. And I don't think we've been in a group of 6.
No, I think we've been in 5 or less. 5.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
That's right. So, although we might have started out with 6 and then we had an attrition. So the other thing I want to point out is, you know, we're talking about what's going to make this pandemic go away. There's a few things. One of them is I can't emphasize enough that if we do hygiene enough, if you wash your hands and you mask and you isolate and you don't distance, if the virus has nowhere to go, it can't spread. So say you get sick and you isolate and you don't spread it to anyone else. Well, that's one more vector of spread that just went away. So if everybody would do that, if everybody who was sick just stayed in and didn't expose anybody else, the virus would have nowhere to go and it would just die out. People's immune systems would kill it, or, you know, unfortunately, people who have it, some people will die. But the virus will die with them. and people who fight it off, the virus stays with them and they don't spread it anymore. So if you're wearing a mask and you don't contract it, eventually the virus will go away. The problem is we don't have enough compliance in this country, and that's why we have hotspots in places like Florida and Oklahoma and Arizona, because people are not complying. They opened up too quick and they're not doing their hand washing and masking and all the things that they're supposed to do. The virus can die out that way. It's not going to just flow through the population. It's science. If the virus has no vector, if it has no place to go, it can die out that way. So you're doing your part when you wash your hands and you wear a mask. And like I said, when you go to the store, the mask has to be covering your mouth and your nose. And if you can't do that, if for whatever reason, whether it's emotional, whether it's a health reason, or you're just so uncomfortable that you have to keep either your nose or your mouth uncovered, then don't go in the store. Don't go places where you're going to be close to people and in that state. And if you need stuff from the store, get somebody else to do it. Many stores will curbside your groceries for you, and you can get someone else to shop for you. And usually you can get the store to shop for you. So just do that. Be kind to other people. If you're going into a store with your nose uncovered and your mouth covered, you're being very, very selfish and you're being inconsiderate of other people. And you could, and I'm going to just say it, you could kill somebody. And you could also die yourself. So please be aware of this. All right. So let's talk about some other stuff. My next topic for today, I wanted to talk about diverticulosis and diverticuli and diverticulitis and that sort of thing. So we'll get on to that topic. So what's a diverticulum? It's no fun. And diverticulosis. So there's diverticulosis and diverticulitis. And diverticulosis is you have the presence of diverticuli. And diverticulitis is when those diverticuli get inflamed.
Mm.
All right. So that's what it is. You know that before the 20th century, I'm going to sigh.
Okay.
Before the 20th century, diverticular disease was rare.
Oh, dear.
So it's one of those. Yeah. What changed?
What changed?
I want to say white flour. Mm. White flour, sugar, not enough produce, not enough exercise, not enough water. People sitting around. The stuff, if something is rare before the 20th century, there's got to be something about the 20th century that makes it happen more. Mm. So what is that? That's what it is. Diverticulosis is it happens because of poor tone of your colon. And why would you have poor tone in your colon? Because you don't exercise it enough. Why do you have poor tone in your arm?
Because you don't exercise it.
Why do you have poor tone in your legs?
Because you don't exercise them.
All right. So how do you think you get the diverticuli?
There you go.
You don't exercise your colon enough. How do you exercise your colon?
I sure exercise mine a lot.
Right. And how do you do that?
Well, I give it all sorts of great foods, like especially like leafy greens and other, you know, various good food.
What's the main component of that food that keeps you, that colon exercising?
The roughage?
Yes.
Yeah.
I was going to say it begins with an F, ends with an R, got an IBE in the middle.
Oh.
Which is basically the same thing. Roughage is, that's funny. Roughage is an old-timey term.
Well, it's a word people use.
They used to say it.
You got to get your roughage.
It's an old-timer thing.
I'm an old-timer.
You're dating yourself.
That's because you're a young puppy.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
56-year-old young puppy.
Younger than I.
Right.
Mm.
Yeah. Oh, so we have an interesting comment here.
Yeah, what do we got?
So Carolyn writes in that she went to a hospital in Kent for a procedure, and the lady that checked her in didn't have her nose covered.
Oh.
She didn't want to be rude, but she was afraid to say something. So she said to her, "Do you know you're not wearing your mask right?" She says, "I've been here all day and we're 6 feet apart." And she didn't cover her nose, and she's not happy about this. Well, and this is in a hospital. So, Carolyn, you have every right to be unhappy about this.
Of all places,
right.
In a hospital.
Right.
Don't they know?
Well, she's saying, look, I've been here all day. I don't want to cover my nose.
Well, that's no
excuse. And we're 6 feet apart.
Then go home.
Right. If you can't do it. I know.
Go home. If you can't handle it, go home.
But, I mean, even if you're going to do that and you're facing the public and the public calls you out for it, if you have to take a mask break, at least go in the bathroom. Don't do it in when you're in front of somebody. Well, my goodness.
Another option would be to wear a shield.
And Carolyn points out that she should have felt safe. Yes, Carolyn, you should have felt safe. And that woman made you feel unsafe. And that wasn't right. And Carolyn, you would have had the right to say something to her supervisor when you went in for your procedure, said something to somebody else, because she wouldn't cover. You said something directly to her and she didn't fix the problem. And you could have said something to somebody else. And you should continue to be as careful as you're being. So you were right. I would feel very uncomfortable. I did feel it. I went to the store yesterday and I saw all these people with their noses uncovered.
Yeah, it's really annoying.
And it's very, so we stay the heck away from them and we get out of the store as fast as we can.
Yep. Yeah, that's why
that's what we do.
Into brief shopping trips now.
Right.
If you're going to go get what you want
and
don't
get out.
Mill around.
No.
Just get out of there.
Right. Especially when you see multiple people uncovered.
Right. Right.
Yeah, and go to the store as infrequently as possible.
Or half covered, we'll say. Semi-naked.
Well, but this is a situation where, yes, they're half naked, and it doesn't matter. Like, you could be half naked and have one part of you covered, one part of you not. But this is a situation where covering your mouth but not your nose doesn't make a difference. You
right.
have to have them both covered
it's
because
the
they're
same.
Both...
Right.
You get why do you think when you go get the nasal swab, it's a nasal swab. They swab your nose and your throat when they test you.
Right.
So what do you think covering your mouth and not your nose does? It's just people they're rationalizing, well, I'm wearing the mask, but I can't breathe, so I'm going to leave my nose uncovered. That they're rationalizing and they're not being smart about it.
You know when you really can't breathe? When your lungs
exactly.
fill up with water and you
right.
can no longer breathe anymore because you have a coronavirus?
Right, because you're intubated. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. That's when you really can't breathe.
Yeah, that's true. And neither can the people you infect. Right. So let's go back to diverticular disease. It was rare before the 20th century. So therefore, 20th century stuff makes diverticular disease more common. And the big treatment for diverticular disease is fiber, fiber, fiber. So people are not eating enough fiber, fiber, fiber. So things that make you regular, so things that cause constipation can ultimately cause diverticular disease. So what is diverticular disease? Well, if you look at a colon that has diverticuli, it looks like it has little balloons off it. So you know when you have a balloon and it hasn't been blown up, it's kind of taut, and then after you blow it up, it gets kind of floppy.
Mm-hmm.
So what you'll see when a patient has diverticuli is that they're basically cul-de-sacs. You know, you're supposed to have a smooth, straight. Your colon is shaped like kind of like a box, and it starts. Starts at your liver and the upper right-hand side of your abdomen, and then it goes across your abdomen to the left side, and then it goes down, and it goes back towards the center, and it comes out. And it comes out the back, and that back is where your rectum is. So diverticuli are, and it's supposed to be just a straight road. When you have diverticuli, what you'll see these little balloonings off of the colon, and they're little pouches, and they're places that they're cul-de-sacs. So they're little pouches. It's like if you had a road and you had a few cul-de-sacs off the road. That's what diverticuli look like. And they don't have great tone. And the problem with the diverticuli is stuff can get in there and not get out. Now, if you eat enough fiber and you make it so that your transit time is fast enough, the diverticuli will not tend to fill up. So even if you have some, you can improve your situation. What I don't know is if diverticuli can resolve. What I do know is that you can prevent yourself from having problems with your diverticuli by eating a lot of fiber. So the way that's probably happening is that you have a fast enough transit time so that not much is getting into those pouches, that it's just bypassing, it's just taking the highway straight on through. And so that's what you want to do. And it is possible for people to have diverticuli and have no symptoms for years and years and years. But if those pouches fill up and then become infective, infected, that's what diverticulitis is. And diverticulitis can be a medical emergency. Now, mind you, I want to remind you that any kind of extreme abdominal pain is a medical emergency. If you have extreme abdominal pain that won't go away, and it can be accompanied by nausea and vomiting or just really, really extreme pain, don't wait. That's like having symptoms of a heart attack. If you have symptoms of extreme abdominal pain, go to the ER. And we call that in medicine an acute abdomen. And an acute abdomen has to be assessed, because the problem with an acute abdomen is if that you have something in there that's very inflamed, it can rupture and then you have sepsis. And you're not supposed to have bacteria in the lumen, in outside of the organs of your abdomen. So you're not supposed to have free fluid or free bacteria in the peritoneum, inside your abdomen, outside of the organs. And so when you have a diverticulum that has food in it, that has become infected, it causes inflammation. And when things become inflamed, it hurts their integrity and they're more likely to blow up. And so if the diverticulum becomes inflamed, it can grow, and then the covering of the diverticulum becomes more friable, more able to break open, and then it can break open. Now you have you can get peritonitis. So, and that's very dangerous, and it's a medical emergency. So if you're diagnosed, and how do you get diagnosed with diverticulosis? So diverticulosis is what we call it when you just have the diverticuli. You can just say diverticular disease. Diverticulitis is when they become inflamed. Now, you can have a low-grade diverticulitis that's not serious enough for you to have surgery. That can happen. And sometimes you'll be diagnosed with diverticulitis and you'll be given antibiotics, and that'll be that. And then you'll take the antibiotics, and if it improves, then, you know, you'll be sent on your way. You'll be given instructions how to treat your diverticulitis. And then if it resolves, then you'll be instructed on how to make it so that you're less likely to get the diverticulitis. All right. So what are the symptoms? So symptoms of diverticulitis, they can be, as I said, they can be mild to severe. They can appear suddenly or they can develop gradually. It can be strong abdominal pain. You can get bloating, diarrhea, or constipation. And if you have very severe diverticulitis, you can have severe abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, fever, chills. You can have bloody stool, and you can have rectal bleeding. And, of course, abdominal pain is the most common symptom of diverticulitis. Mostly occurs in the lower left side. So I think the lower diverticuli tend to happen more likely in the lower left side because it's just the nature of how the colon functions. So when your digested food enters your colon, it's entering at the ileocecal valve. And the ileocecal valve is on the lower right side of your abdomen, and that's where that's the first part. That's where the small intestine attaches to the large intestine, and the entry point at that entry point, your food is still very liquidy. And the reason you get loose stool, or we think of it as diarrhea, but the reason you get that is because the mechanism for drawing water out of your stool has been compromised when you have diarrhea. So there's some kind of inflammation, irritation, infection, whatever, that's making it so the membrane transport is not working properly and you're not withdrawing water back into your body. So when you're having a normal, healthy stool, as you know, it's just the right amount of dry. It's a fully formed stool and it's easy to pass. It's not super dry, but it's dry enough so that you can pass it and you're not experiencing it as diarrhea. That's because when that food enters the ileocecal valve, it's very liquidy. And so it enters liquidy, and then when it gets, as it's transferring from that ileocecal valve, it's going up and then it goes to your transverse colon across from right to left in the top of your abdomen and then traveling down. By the time it gets into the descending colon, which is on the left side of your body, it's pretty dry. So if you don't move your bowels well, you're more likely to have stuff getting stuck there. And if you have stool that's pressing against your colon at that point, and you have poor tone, that's one way that you get the diverticuli. So the diverticuli are most likely to happen in your descending colon. Doesn't that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Makes sense. All right.
Totally.
So that's why the pain is likely to occur on the left side.
So what if you hydrate more?
Right. That's one of the things that helps.
Help?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So we'll explain it a little bit more. As we said, the pouches form along your digestive tract, and the diverticulitis when they become inflamed. To diagnose it, if you have a routine colonoscopy, sometimes you'll get diagnosed with diverticulosis during the routine colonoscopy. The doctor will see it and then will give you instructions on how to prevent diverticulitis. That's one way that gets diagnosed. The other way it gets diagnosed, unfortunately, is if you have an acute abdomen and you go to the ER and then they give you a CAT scan. Because when you go to the ER, they don't have time to do a colonoscopy. And colonoscopy is not indicated when you're in an acute state. It's much safer to do a CAT scan. And CAT scans are very fast. They're a fast way to get a really good view of what's going on inside that abdomen. So that's another way you'll get diagnosed. You can get diagnosed with an ultrasound, but generally if you're in the ER, you're going to get a CAT scan. Because like I said, you can put somebody in a CAT scan machine, and CAT scan machine takes seconds to do. It's really fast. An MRI, if you need further diagnosis, if you're not in an acute state, you can have an MRI. An MRI will give you a better view of what's going on. And an ultrasound can be helpful too. But again, in the ER, you're probably not going to get that. You're going to get that CAT scan. If you're not in an acute state and you're just going to the gastroenterologist, you know, your doctor's going to perform a physical exam, maybe a digital rectal exam, and might do any of these other procedures that you might be scheduled for: an ultrasound, abdominal MRI, CT, or even an X-ray. And also, again, if you're not acute, you might get a colonoscopy. You could get a stool test to see if you have to culture your stool, because C. diff, Clostridium difficile, is an opportunistic infection that if it overgrows, it can cause severe inflammation and infection and cause a lot of diarrhea. And it can also cause, if you have C. diff in your diverticuli, it will cause a lot of inflammation. You could have a urine test to make sure you don't also have a UTI. And then also blood test. And if you, women might get a pelvic exam too, to make sure there isn't coexisting gynecological issues. And you might also get a pregnancy test because you can have an ectopic pregnancy that can coexist with a diverticulum. So if you're of childbearing age, you might get a pregnancy test as well. Most diverticulitis is uncomplicated, meaning that you don't have to necessarily get surgery, that you'll just be treated with antibiotics and that'll be it. But about 25%, you can get complications, like you can get an abscess. That's an infected pocket that's filled with pus. And the infection can spread beyond the abscess. You can also get a fistula where you get, the inflamed diverticulum attaches to another organ and creates a channel to that other organ. That's really dangerous. So that abnormal connection will communicate infection to that next organ. Or you can have that fistula, you can have the diverticulum attached to the omentum and then to the skin. That's really bad.
It just sounds awful.
Awful, I know.
Sounds like terrible things.
I know. And you can also get and the big reason why you do the acute, if you have an acute abdomen, you go to the ER, is you can get an intestinal perforation. Yeah.
Ooh.
So that's what we were worried about with you.
Right. Well, that's why we ended up doing that other thing.
That other thing.
I had the.
That's why you had surgery.
No, well, no. I also, when I went to get my colon, when I went to get tested, I tested the non-perforating way.
Right.
Right.
in a box. We
came to right.
Came to the house. It was a box.
Oh, yes. Oh, meaning right. that you, meaning okay.
Instead of having a colonoscopy.
Right. Okay. That you had a, right. You had got the, you, got, chose, you had Cologuard. Right.
I chose
okay.
Cologuard.
Yeah. All right. No, but it's what I'm saying about. Is that that you're worried about getting perforated during a colonoscopy.
Yeah.
I see. Meanwhile, your colon was not the problem when you had your surgery. Your surgery was in your small intestine. I know.
Right.
I understand. You're worried about perforation anyway. That's fine.
Well,
the thing is, with if you're going to do so, there's a procedure you can do called Cologuard and you can do it in lieu of doing a colonoscopy. And it's a genetic test. And what you do is you send your stool off to this company that does genetic testing on your stool to test for genetics for colon cancer. And if you have no symptoms and you have no family history of colon cancer, and then it can be a nice alternative to getting a colonoscopy. Colonoscopy comes with risks. And one of which is intestinal perforation. Other is reaction to the anesthesia. And the other thing is you have to, and then you have to do the prep. And the prep that cleans you out. And some people do not respond well to the prep. And the prep, whether you respond well to it or not, having to take a substance where you clear out your intestines like that is really not good for you. And plus, you have to take a couple days off from work. So Ron and I both decided that we didn't have risk factors for colon cancer. So we both did Cologuard. It was nice.
Yeah.
I mean, you do it at home. Yeah. You just send off a stool sample,
send
and that's
off
it.
A sample.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, yeah. It's easy to do and no prep, and it's that part of that's very nice. And we did our colon cancer screen. That was a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So also, when you have diverticulitis, you can also have a blockage in your intestine obstruction.
Mm.
So treating diverticulitis depends on how severe your case is. If you have a mild case, you're probably going to get advice on diet and also get some antibiotics. And if you're getting antibiotics, and I know about it, you're going to get probiotics too. Because if you're taking an antibiotic, antibiotics kill your good bacteria. So one of the unfortunate things is you have bacteria in your digestive system that's causing the diverticulitis or, you know, aggravating the diverticulitis. And so you're given antibiotics for it, and you need the good bacteria in your digestive system to fight the diverticular disease. And that's one of the things that we do to help to prevent you from getting it in the first place. Make sure you're ingesting good probiotics all the time. So when you're taking an antibiotic, we like to offer you antibiotics that can't be killed by or probiotics that can't be killed by antibiotics. Although the problem is when you get diverticular disease, you may be given only a bacteria killing antibiotic, and you may be given metronidazole. It's not unusual to be given metronidazole. Metronidazole is broad spectrum and will kill other organisms other than bacteria, and will kill fungal elements as well. So we might just give you probiotics, and it's kind of like you're giving the probiotic, giving the antibiotic, and so we're hoping that some of the probiotic will take. And even if we give Sacbalardi, if you're getting metronidazole, the metronidazole is probably going to kill some of that Saccharomyces boulardii. But the Saccharomyces boulardii is going to set up, and it's going to be good for you. If you're really sick with the diverticulitis, you might get IV antibiotics.
Mm.
If you are in... If you are very complicated, you might have to undergo surgery to have the diverticuli removed. If God forbid you have a perforation, if you have an opening into the digestive system, you might have to undergo surgery, and you might have to have resection of your colon. And also, if you have peritonitis, you'll have to have your abdomen irrigated, and it might require a few days hospital stay. Usually when you have abdominal surgery, you're in for a few days hospital stay.
I know that.
Yes, we know. Yeah. And then I have to go visit you, and like, well, yeah. Although
well,
if you were in
first,
there now.
First you have to worry about me a lot.
That, yes, that's very important. And be told not to come home from Florida.
That's right. Well, there was nothing you could do.
And you were safe. You were safe in the hospital.
I was safe.
And then when I came back, I was able to visit you in the hospital because it was the before COVID.
Right.
Now, if you go to the hospital, I don't know if they'll let me visit you.
I don't think they do anymore. I think that that's really restricted.
Say hi to Bill Damaris.
I did.
Okay.
I did. That's good. I said hi to Bill. All right. He said hi, guys.
All right.
He said hi back.
So anyway, if you have diverticuli, you might be given acetaminophen for your symptoms.
Yep.
You might be, and as I told you, you might be given metronidazole. You might also be given amoxicillin or moxifloxacin. Amoxicillin is a penicillin derivative, and if you're allergic to penicillin, you won't be given amoxicillin. You might be given moxifloxacin, which is fluoroquinolone. And the fluoroquinolones are anything that ends in a sin. So your moxifloxacin, ciprofloxacin, levofloxacin, they all tend to be used because I think they're not well absorbed. So they tend to go through, they're not well absorbed by the digestive system or the kidneys, which is a good thing if you're trying to treat a digestive condition as well as a urinary tract condition. So men will often be given ciprofloxacin for prostatitis, and women will be given fluoroquinolones for urinary tract infections. Mm. Unfortunately, the fluoroquinolones have a bad side effect, which is they can cause tendon rupture. So I have patients who come in who've had some injury from taking fluoroquinolones. And then, of course, the penicillins, you have to just make sure if amoxicillin is a penicillin derivative, you have to make sure you're not allergic to that. You might have a needle drainage to drain pus or fluid, and you might have surgery to drain pus or repair a fistula or remove infected segments of the colon. Sometimes if it's really, really severe, you can have enough of your colon taken out that you need an ostomy, that you will have a portion of your bowel now communicating with the outside of your body, and you'll have a bag. Sometimes the ostomy bag can be reversed. So you'll have it for a while until you heal, and then it can be reversed and it can be reattached to your colon. So there's disagreement about diet and diverticuli. When you have acute diverticulitis, my advice would be to stick with mostly solid food. This is a time that if you have acute diverticulitis, you don't want to be eating fiber. You want to be eating, but you also don't want to be eating bread because you're probably allergic to it. I would not eat white bread, and I wouldn't eat white rice. What I do is eat a lot of broths and soups and mushy things. And if you eat vegetables, they should be pureed or cooked. That they should really be cooked down. Quite honestly, if you're going to eat something healthy, that pureed vegetables is a good way to go. And soups and broths, if they have any meat in them, that should be very, very mushy. Otherwise, just do the broth. And you do that until you're mostly healed, and then you can get back to eating a higher fiber diet. And you also might be asked to limit your consumption of red meat just because red meat takes a long time to get through your system. I don't think I would restrict bone broth from red meat. If you have bone broth and it's made from beef, I think that's fine. The issue is that the beef itself, the muscle fibers itself, are going to take a long time to get through.
Harder to digest.
You want things that are going to have faster throughput. So for diverticuli, if somebody's going to take something, if they're not too serious and they want to take something besides antibiotics, I will often offer Golden Seal. I like berberines and golden, especially berberines. So berberines are a great antimicrobial. They protect your liver. They help regulate your blood sugar, and they can kill a lot of stuff. So there's a lot of natural medicine that you can do. So somebody who comes in, they have diverticuli. If somebody has a diverticulitis and it's not severe enough for them to have surgery, then I'm going to be recommending Golden Seal and berberines, really. Golden Seal is one of the herbs that contains berberines in it. And so does Coptis. So does Oregon grape. And so does Mahonia. So there are a number of herbs that you can extract berberines from. And Golden Seal is a little, I don't know how endangered it is. Oregon grape is not endangered. It's really hard to beat back if you're in the Northwest, and it's a great source of berberine. So you can often extract berberines from you can extract berberines from Oregon grape very easily, and they kill, it'll kill anything, and it's astringent too, so it makes you feel better. It helps to regulate your blood sugar and your liver function at the same time. So it's very nice. So I would give that to somebody who had acute diverticular disease. I might also give oregano oil. And I would certainly give some kind of broad spectrum probiotic. Or I might just give Lactobacillus GG, which is a version of Lactobacillus rhamnosus. That's a good one for acute infections and diverticular disease. It sets up nicely. So, and then to avoid diverticulosis, what you want to do is maintain a healthy body weight, get regular exercise. What you want to do basically is all the same things you would do to prevent diverticulitis and to treat your diverticulosis is the same kind of things you would do to prevent constipation. You're going to drink a lot of water, like you said, and you're going to maintain a healthy body weight. If you have a lot of body fat that's pressing down on your abdomen, you're not going to get as good flow through your abdomen. So if you can keep your abdominal fat down, that's going to help your digestive system to work better. You're going to eat a high fiber diet. And if you're not, you have no acute diverticulitis, eating like 25 grams of fiber a day is a very good thing. So that's eat your fruits. You don't have to take a fiber supplement unless you want to, but you can get a lot of fiber in just by eating a big salad every day, a big stir fry, having several servings of fruit, have another serving of vegetables in a day, eat nuts and seeds if you're not allergic, eat flax seeds, eat chia seeds. Chia seeds are amazingly high in fiber, and if you tolerate them, they're a great thing to eat. And if you are not, if you don't have acute diverticulitis, you can eat seeds. That's been debunked that you have to avoid seeds because they're going to get stuck in the pouches. I would only avoid seeds and high fiber things if you're acute. You know, then you have to eat everything very mushy that's going to go through. It's not going to irritate your digestive system too much. If you're not acute, if you don't have diverticulitis, you can eat high fiber things. In fact, you should. You also want to make sure you get enough vitamin D. Remember that getting exercise helps to push your digestive system along. You have better throughput if you get regular exercise. That combination of exercise and drinking a lot of water is very simple. And then avoiding cigarette smoke, because cigarette smoke, the nicotine in the cigarette smoke slows down the functioning of your digestive system.
Yet another reason to avoid cigarette smoke. Yep.
So there's family history, not eating enough fiber, not enough vitamin D, obesity, physical inactivity. Also, using too many NSAIDs can increase your risk of diverticulitis, probably because they block certain parts of your inflammatory system and they upregulate others. And the other thing is they tend to cause ulcerations and bleeding. So there's another whole thing. You can get diverticuli in your bladder and your esophagus. And drinking too much alcohol can also cause diverticulitis because of the irritation to the digestive system. So there you go. So please wear your mask. If you go to the store, cover your nose and your mouth. And if you can't do it, get somebody else to shop for you or get your groceries curbsided or your, you know, whatever you're getting at the store, curbsided. And eat a lot of fiber and eat your fruits and vegetables. It's a great time of year to eat your fruits and vegetables. There's so much wonderful stuff available right now.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. So I'm going to go. So thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath. You've been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host, Ron Meniza. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, and Spotify. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at Fran Storch, ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org.